Eisen. Thank you. We're going to go on to our sixth case of the day. But before we do, is 072634 Bynum versus Buss?
Good morning. May it please the court and my opposing counsel. My name is Eric Randall. I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, Cleveland Bynum, and much like the gentleman earlier from Clear Channel, this is my rookie performance before this court, so I'm honored to be here.
And we are honored to have you here.
Thank you very much. The issue before the court today is whether the district court erred when it denied Mr. Bynum's petition for habeas corpus regarding his claim that his trial counsel was ineffective in failing to adequately seek to suppress his two statements to the police. It's black letter law at this point that under the AEDPA, a federal court will not grant a writ of habeas corpus regards to a state prisoner unless the state decision was contrary to clearly established federal law or involved in unreasonable application of clearly established federal law.
Now, the Indiana Appellate Court didn't think there was a reasonable probability that Mr. Bynum's testimony would have been credited over that of the three police detectives and over his own two written waivers. In what sense was that finding unreasonable?
That holding by the Indiana Court of Appeals, specifically the passage you mentioned, is both contrary to the federal law and unreasonable, is an unreasonable application. Regarding how it's contrary, that part of the decision there, the Indiana Court of Appeals was addressing the voluntariness of the statements. It's been well established since at least 1973, Schneckloff v. Bustamante, that the totality of the circumstances is a test for voluntariness. Now, the Indiana Court of Appeals, however, in its holding there, said had his testimony that he offered at his PCR trial been offered at his criminal trial, there is not a reasonable probability that the trial court would have concluded the statements were admissible. That reasonable probability, quote, is more of a takeoff of the second prong of the Strickland test rather than totality of the circumstances test.
But, they do use those words, reasonable probability, but if you look at the rest of what they write, they seem to be looking at all of the circumstances that were around, what the police detective said, what he wrote in his waivers, what he claimed, and Mr. Graddick's testimony, as I recall, was something to the effect that if he had ever shared that anything like the sort of coercion he described was going on, Mr. Graddick would have instantly made a motion. It looked to me, de facto, as though they really were looking at everything. Or at least reading it the way we're supposed to approach this, maybe I should modify what I'm saying that way. We aren't sitting around to grade the state courts. The state courts need to apply the correct test in substance.
I understand that, and going off that point, if you do look at what the Indiana Court of Appeals analyzed, it did do so also in an unreasonable manner. It characterized there, and the district court kind of followed this state court's opinion that there was this consistent testimony of the three officers. Really, all that happened here, you have the three officers say, yes, he signed a waiver, yes, he made a statement. And it goes without saying, a waiver done under coercion isn't worth the paper it's written on. And the court wholesale ignored a whole bunch of other issues regarding Mr. Bynum's statements. It ignored the amount of time he was there, which he was arrested the morning of February 18th. At approximately 10 a.m., he didn't start giving his first statement until 9 that night. It concluded at 1 in the morning.
Does the record show where he was? I had the impression, but maybe this is wrong from the record, that although he's there for a fairly long time, given the circumstances of the arrest, it's not as though he's sitting on the hot seat every minute of that time being interrogated. I had the impression that he was brought into an interrogation room at some point, has his discussions with him, signs his statement, then he goes away again, then he comes back later.
I think Mr. Bynum's testimony makes clear that when he was brought in, he was first brought to the interrogation room handcuffed with his left arm across his body to the right-hand chair, obviously in an uncomfortable situation, never given food, never given water, never allowed to go to the restroom until after he gave a statement.
But that's his testimony. We have the lawyer testifying that at least there's no contemporaneous account of that that Mr. Bynum made. Right? Mr. Bynum never says to his lawyer, hey, Mr. Braddock, you know, these waivers that I signed, as you put it, are not worth the paper they're written on because they were coerced.
Well, I think he explained his, you know, according to Bynum's testimony, he explained to his attorney the circumstances that went on. And I think it goes without saying if what Mr. Bynum says is true regarding being handcuffed, the time spent, no food, no water, it goes without saying that they were coerced, whether or not they were, obviously they were signed, but, he didn't, even if he didn't specifically tell Mr. Braddock, look, I was coerced, I mean, I think it's implied in his story.
So let me ask you this. Is it your position that every criminal defense attorney has to put his client on the stand during a suppression hearing or be deemed ineffective, even if, and it doesn't matter whether the lawyer believes his client is telling the truth?
Well, I don't know that I would draw such a bright line, but certainly in this case, I think his failure to put him on the stand made his performance fall beneath the objective standard.
Yeah, but the reason he gave was he didn't believe his client was telling the truth, and so let's just leave it to that group, that defense attorneys who don't believe their clients are telling the truth, are they obligated to put their clients on the stand?
Well, in Indiana, under Thomas v. State, there is a rule of law that says testimony from a defendant given during a suppression hearing is not admissible at trial. So if you put him up there,
right, just like in the federal system,
well,
use it to impeach.
I think at that point you have to throw caution to the wind, and he basically got those police officers on the stand, and he asked them the foundation questions that the prosecutor asked on direct. He hardly delved into coercion at all. Did he sign the statements? Yes. Was he sober? Yes. Did you threaten him? No. Of course the cops are going to answer that. And when he made his argument, he said, I wanted to show that they were done under coercion. The officers testified to the contrary. That right there, he admits he blew it. He should have put Bynum on a stand. There was no other way.
Even if he thought he was going to lie, I mean, it's a difficult position to take. And if the state courts were willing to accept Mr. Graddick's explanation, does AEDPA allow us to second-guess them?
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly when it's found to be an unreasonable...
In part, a credibility call, isn't it? The state courts are aware of what Mr. Bynum's story is by the time you get to post-conviction. And they're aware of what Mr. Graddick says, and they accept Mr. Graddick's explanation, as I read it.
Well, the state court certainly did, but the district court had a hard time.
Right, the district court thought that he couldn't quite see it. But ultimately, in an AEDPA case, we have to decide if the state court handled the situation in an unreasonable way. So that's why I'm focusing on them.
Correct. I think in this case, the district court saw it the right way.
Let me ask you this, Ken, in the state court, because in the federal system you can take this into account. You could take into account certain statements say at sentencing, let's say after someone has been sentenced. If there's a straight-up denial during a suppression hearing, I mean, there are certain circumstances where that testimony can be used in sentencing. Is that true in Indiana?
That I honestly couldn't tell the answer to that question. I wish I could, but... I really don't know. I'm not a very...
I understand. Thank you.
into the criminal practice. Well, my light is on, so I will pause here and pass the...
Wouldn't have guessed that from how well you're doing.
Oh, thank you.
Okay. Ms. Nicholas, hello. How are you?
It's fine.
Our caboose today.
Yeah. I was on Friday as well.
Oh.
May it please the court. My name is Kelly Miklos, and I represent the appellee Alan Finnan, superintendent of the Wabash Valley Correctional Facility in Carlisle, Indiana. this court should affirm the district court's order denying Bynum habeas relief because the Indiana Court of Appeals reasonably determined that Bynum received the effective assistance of trial counsel. The Indiana State Courts and the Federal District Court have found Bynum's allegations of police misconduct and coercion not to be credible, and that had Bynum testified at the suppression hearing, as he testified at the state post-conviction hearing, Bynum would not have been successful in suppressing his statements to the police. Bynum cannot show that this credibility determination was clearly erroneous in light of the police officer's testimony, the two waiver of rights forms signed by Bynum, and his trial counsel's own testimony on post-conviction.
Let me ask you a quick question here, because I guess what the Indiana courts are doing here, effectively, is they're kind of reconstructing what they would have thought at a suppression hearing at which Mr. Bynum had testified. Now, credibility calls, ultimate findings of fact and the like, I would assume in Indiana, are made by the judge in the suppression hearing, not by any other finder of fact, right?
At a regular suppression hearing,
it's the judge who resolves the
makes
fact.
Makes the initial
it's
credibility.
It's not anybody else. So that said, do you see this as a case where the Indiana court, the trial court on post-conviction, is really just nunc pro tunc, if you will, finding facts about what it would have thought had this allegation by Mr. Bynum been raised in a timely manner?
I think the post-conviction judge was in a position of determining at the post-conviction hearing whether Bynum was credible
make a credibility assessment as to Mr. Bynum's testimony?
The post-conviction judge?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, he it's did. Implicit in his findings that he did not give any credibility to Bynum's testimony.
Well, you say implicit. There certainly wasn't.
There was no specific finding of credibility one way or the other. That's correct. But we don't need this.
Yeah. How could the Indiana appellate court or any court determine whether there's a reasonable likelihood that his motion to suppress would have been granted had he testified?
I think the initial credibility assessment is made at the post-conviction hearing whether Bynum is telling the truth. Not necessarily if he would have said all of that, what would their decision have been?
I hope we're on the same train, but there's, as far as I could see, there was no credibility assessment by the post-conviction court as to his testimony.
And I agree that there was no specific finding, but I disagree that there was, in fact, a credibility determination. The post-conviction court, if you read its findings, did not give any credit to Bynum's testimony regarding the circumstances surrounding the statements or what he did or did not tell to his attorney.
But what I'm saying is that court's the only court that heard his testimony, right?
Yes.
Doesn't that oblige that court to make an actual, real, specific credibility assessment?
Would it have helped us on habeas review? Certainly, but it's not necessary. And in fact, if you read the determination that it made, it didn't credit anything that Bynum said. So it didn't go through whether or not, given everything that he said, whether or not it would have been the statements would have been voluntary or not. And that was within its purview to do.
So it was nunc pro tunc, as Sister Wood said. Right?
Correct.
Okay. What kind of a way is that to run a court? What kind of a way is this to run a justice system? Oh.
The fact is that the post-conviction court did not believe Bynum's self-serving, uncorroborated statements. Later on post-conviction, there was nothing to show that that is, in fact, what occurred at the time he gave his two statements. And that was a credibility assessment that the post-conviction judge had the ability to make and did make. And
I guess there are two possibilities at the original trial. Possibility number one, at this mid-trial suppression hearing, Mr. Graddick, in fact, calls Bynum, and the post-conviction court has said, we think in that instance Bynum's testimony would have been regarded as not credible, the motion to suppress would have failed, everything would have gone forward as it did, so even if he should have called Mr. Bynum, there was no prejudice. Or possibility number two, maybe Mr. Bynum never even says these things because he hasn't thought of them yet.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Under habeas review, Bynum cannot show that the Indiana Court of Appeals holding was objectively unreasonable in light of clearly established federal law and the facts presented in the state court. If there are no further questions.
Well, let me ask you this. Shouldn't Graddick have given him the opportunity to tell his side of the story if that was the only evidence he had that the statements he made at the time were not voluntary? In other words, this was the only evidence that defense counsel had, what Bynum told him. Wasn't like he could look to any other alternatives. Shouldn't he have been given that opportunity, even if he didn't believe him?
In order to answer your question, I think are you making the assumption that, for the purpose of the question, that everything Bynum said at the post-conviction hearing, he in fact communicated to Graddick?
Yes.
Okay. In that instance, no. I think he was able to make the strategic decision. He talked to Bynum before the motion to suppress. He decided that Bynum's account was vulnerable, that he could poke holes in it, and that his best shot was to rely on Bynum's statements, a fear that he made in the statements themselves, and then try to attack the police testimony, perhaps get them to say things that were against one another.
But those statements were not very strong in terms of, you know, in his statements, they were not very strong in terms of how he was treated by the police.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
They
so,
weren't
I mean,
as
it wasn't,
strong.
It certainly didn't flesh out what he would have said, theoretically.
Correct. They weren't as strong. Thank you.
Thank you. So now you come here every Monday and Friday, is that it?
No offense, but I hope not.
Oh.
It's a long drive from Indianapolis.
Regarding what you addressed, whether or not the PCR court found Bynum to be credible or incredible, I agree that it is not. That determination was not made. And by the same token, it did not make the credibility determination with regards to the officers either. I think what it probably did, and the Court of Appeals followed that reasoning, is that you have your three officers, your one defendant, three versus one. You know, what wins? It really failed to take into the totality.
You have the two statements also.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me?
You also have those two statements.
Correct, but as far as what the...
5-1, it seems.
True, but obviously his testimony pretty much negated, you know, why those statements were made. And I think the Court of Appeals basically followed the same 3-1 thing with ignoring the fact that a lot of what took place was simply between Bynum and Detective Donald without Moxley or Galt there to participate in that. So it becomes more of a 1-on-1 credibility ratio rather than your 3-1. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Mr. Randall, were you retained or were you?
I was retained.
You were retained. Well, you did a good job whether you were retained or appointed, and you did a good job, and I know that you were